go for a walk or you're riding your bike, does it really annoy you when you see dog poo that someone hasn't picked up? It does me, and I see people walking dogs and they look around sometimes just to see if anyone's watching so they know whether they have to pick it up or not. So that makes us a funny lot, isn't it? We're all so upset about dog poo. What about everyone else's poo? I think that sometimes in Sydney. I'm not insane, I'm sure. Well, I think I'm sure. But I look around at all the apartments and I think, where does it all go? And then you think of a country like India and you must think, gee, what happens there? But we're so shallow, we just press the button, away it goes, and we don't think about it. Well, we have to. It's one of the biggest issues facing the globe. Disposal of human waste. Joining me now to talk about just that is Emeritus Professor ANU and La Trobe Universities, Robin Jeffrey. Robin Jeffrey, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're interested in waste, aren't you? Human waste?
Oh, hugely interested, and have been now for about 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of juicy stories about waste that my colleague and co-author Asadoran at ANU have been, you could say, up to our ears in human waste at some stages. But our interest particularly has been in the Indian dilemmas with waste and the fact that India's been for the last 5 years now embarked on a big cleanup campaign to deal with just that, human waste.
How many toilets are they hoping to have finished by the end of the year?
The goal by October, Mahatma Gandhi's birth anniversary on the 2nd of October, is total elimination of open defecation. That is, nobody will be pooing outside. All poos will be done in a controlled environment of some kind or another. And that will have involved, if it's pronounced successful, will have involved building some hundreds of millions of toilets of one kind or another. A couple of 100 million probably would be the ballpark figure, if one has a ballpark figure for toilet building. So it's a huge construction job, and of course it's a huge technical job too, because not all toilets are equal, as I'm sure you know. As I think most Australians do. Anybody who's over a certain age will have grown up with dunnies and even night men, I think. I don't think there are any more night men in Sydney, but there were.
Not that I know of.
When I came to Australia 45 years ago,
really?
There were still night men in the western suburbs of Sydney, I believe.
Gee, well, that does surprise me. But in any event, you say toilets of all sorts. We did an interview recently focusing on this issue. The Gates Foundation's interested in it. And I hadn't really focused on the size of the problem internationally. And I had no idea how many different countries and companies were trying to find the ideal loo. I mean, in Australia, there's the long drop. That's in national parks and that sort of thing, or the flush loo, and that's about it, really. Now, who would have thought the Swedes would have a number of models? They do, don't they? Tell me about them.
One, as I understand it, separates urine and feces, and that's good because it helps to reduce smell. If you mix urine and feces, you intensify the odor, apparently. And of course, you're separating the two valuable commodities. One is full of nitrogen and the other is full of a whole lot of other things. And in the past, in the Netherlands, in the 18th and 19th century, that was very common, that the urine was valuable. And perhaps that explains all those lovely Dutch tulips and so on. Urine was kept separately and sold to collectors who then flogged it off to farmers and presumably bulb growers in the countryside. So the Swedish model does that separation, and then of course it allows the maximization of value to be extracted from both the urine and the feces. So it's an important refinement of what you can do with poo.
And what about the pee-poo model, the plastic bag idea with the urea in it?
Again, one of these great standalone models where you don't need sewage. And I think you've put your finger on what the real secret to the perfect toilet is. You want it to be standalone. You don't want it to have to be sewered. We love in Australia our flush and forget toilet systems where you pull the chain and everything disappears to an unknown place. But these systems are terribly hard to build in growing cities, and they also require huge amounts of water. So they're really not practical for an awful lot of the world, and less practical for us as we have to husband our water more carefully.
What's the most interesting toilet you've heard about?
I think the most promising ones are the ones that use either a membrane to turn the human waste into something benign and useful for fertilizer. But they're complicated because they have a particularly constituted membrane that has to be inserted into the toilet. And the other kind are those that use a bacteria injected into the chamber of the toilet that has the same effect. The bacteria gets stuck into eating the poo and rendering it benign and turning it, of course, into really good fertilizer, as the Dutch and the Chinese and the Japanese knew hundreds of years ago and utilized hundreds of years ago. But both those models have their problems. The one that uses the bacteria requires the bacteria to be properly managed. You've got to have the right little bugs inserted into the chamber of your toilet to do the right eating. And the one that requires the membrane to be replaced. And someone eventually has to carry away the benign material. And in some countries, particularly India, carrying away even benign poo is not something that respectable people are really very keen to do, indeed not keen to do at all.
Now, if you were a betting person, what would you bet is the best design so far of a toilet to handle sanitation in third world countries?
Well, the ones that appeal to me particularly are the inoculum, where there's the bacteria working in the standalone chamber, and the membrane. The problem with both of them is the maintenance question, but the nice thing about them is they don't require holes in the ground, and they would be suitable, or they are suitable, even for high-rise apartment blocks. But of course, then you've got to have people going in to remove them. One of the models is that there should be businesses that actually come, just as in the old days the milkman used to leave a bottle of milk on your doorstep every morning. Well, once a week the man would knock on the door and say, "I've come to remove your bag or your toilet container," and would cart it away and make a bit of money out of the nice fertilizer that that person was collecting. Those are the models that seem to have a lot of promise, but they have problems with them in that they do require that constant kind of maintenance in a way that the old flush and forget doesn't seem to require maintenance. But of course, we know it does, because sewers have to be kept clean and people have to go down into them to keep them clean. And that's another part of the whole story of sewage and poo and sewage treatment plants.
One imagines what the network of pipes under Mumbai and Kolkata must be like, and New York, for example.
Or London and Paris, Jean Valjean going through in Les Mis, the sewers of Paris, escaping from the police or whoever he was escaping from in Les Miserables. Those Paris sewers, notorious. And in London, of course, in the last couple of years, we've had stories about the fatbergs, the mixtures of cooking oil and so on that block them up. And then people have to go down and chip away at them with pickaxes to actually clear them. That's the kind of mess that can get into a sewer. In Melbourne, we've got the advantage of our science museum out at Werribee, which was a pumping station. And you get some idea of the immense work that went into the Melbourne Metropolitan Board of Works sewage projects of the 1890s and the turn of the last century. Immense engineering projects, which are still working today and maintained today. But these sewers are a great sort of tributes in some ways, but they're not the solution for much of the world in the 21st century. That's where the standalone model, I think, is essential, and the standalone model that doesn't use an awful lot of water.
Well, I have to say, this is a growing problem with a growing population in the world, and it's one that we do not pay enough attention to. I read somewhere that Florence Nightingale was very interested in India because she realised that far more British soldiers died in India because of poor sanitation rather than being shot by a bullet.
Well, that's really, I think, what got the whole public sanitation movement in India going in the 19th century. After the revolt of 1857, the Brits had lost sort of 10 to 1 illness to bullets in the course of suppressing the Indian revolt. And they surveyed their cantonments, their military stations in India, asking them how they handled human waste. And the reports were so voluminous, but also so shocking, they packed them all off to Florence Nightingale, said, "Florence, could you please analyze these and tell us what you think?" And she said, "Well, this is awful. You've been in this country for 100 years and what a mess you've made. You've got to do more." Now, the British didn't do a great deal more in the remaining 90 years they were there. And the problem remains. But Florence Nightingale, of course, was a great believer and a great beneficiary in some ways of the London sewage system that was built from the 1860s, about the same time that she was giving curry, if you like, to the British government for its poor public sanitation performance in India.
Well, you see, Florence Nightingale realised it's a problem. And as you say, we press and flush and don't worry about it, but we're going to have to worry about it. With a growing global population, this is a real problem. Robin Jeffrey, Emeritus Professor at ANU and La Trobe Universities, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this week. I hope you can join us again next week for Counterpoint on Radio National. By the way, to the person who wrote in and said, "No, no, no, you cannot say poo and poo and poop in the same interview, because that's as bad as calling a Becky a cookie. We're not American." Well, you know, okay, you're right, we're not American. But I'm not sure that I don't prefer poop to poo, and I don't mind cookie, actually. Anyway, I take your point. So if you've got something to say, just go to abc.net.au/RN and follow the prompts to Counterpoint and tell us what you want to say. Until next week, I'm Amanda Vanstone. Ciao, ciao.